I'm Francine, bringing you more reviews, recaps, and rants on all your favorite K-dramas. This is Drama Buds, an anime podcast. So hello everyone, welcome to today's episode of Drama Buds. Today I am reviewing Save Me as another one of our horror episodes. Thank you to Charlotte on Discord and to Anne in the last episode on The Guest for recommending this. Although this is a lot less scary than The Guest, it's not exactly horror, it's more of a psychological thriller. Which, you know what, I kinda love. So basic details on Save Me. The PD is the same PD as the movie A Christmas Carol. So if you didn't know, Jin Yong of GOT7 won Best New Actor in Film in the Baeksang Arts Awards last time because of this movie. And it's written by the same writer as Strangers from Hell and Dark Hole. And it stars So Ye Ji, who I've seen in It's Okay to Not Be Okay, Ok Tae Kyun, who I've watched in Vincenzo, and Woo Do Won, who I've seen in My Country, The New Age. So Save Me is about a girl and her family who move into a small village and are sucked into a cult. And years later, she tries to escape from it and asks help from four of her classmates in high school. And together, they infiltrate the cult, they find out their secrets, and they take it down. Let's start with the plot and characters. First, we have Im Sang-mi, played by So Ye Ji. So, Sang-mi's parents and her twin brother moved to Muji, this countryside village, because her father couldn't pay off their debt, so they moved away from Seoul. And they struggled to find a good place to live, and eventually her brother, who had, I think he had a limp or something, her brother was bullied to his death. And that led to her mom, you know, losing her mind in grief. And her father was the only one working. Her father was the only one who they could count on in the family. And then comes this local church, Gusonwon, who worships the mighty new sky under the leadership of the spiritual father. And this church approaches them and, you know, helps them find a better place to live and helps them recover from their grief. And eventually their father, who's basically the only one making decisions now, decides to move into the compound of Gusonwon in the mountains so that their mom can be taken care of in this nursing home and they can have a place to live and all of their needs will be provided for them while they take care of the grounds and they join the worship services. And 3 years later, her father is so deep into the teachings of the church. Her mother still in the nursing home, you know, just as incoherent as ever, believing that Sang-jin, her brother, she can still see him, and if they worship the mighty new sky, they will be together on the ship of salvation. And Sang-mi, 3 years later, still doubts these teachings, but she stays because her father is telling her to, and because they're taking care of her mother. Until she witnesses Apostle Jo, one of the leaders of the cult, killing a child. And every time she tries to run away and tries to tell someone about what happened, even the police, no one believes her. One night, she comes across Im Sang-won and his other friends and she asks them to save her. And though they try to help her escape from Gusonwon, she realizes that she can't keep running from the cult and eventually she plays along with what they want from her so that she can find out more about their secrets, expose it to the world with the help of Sang-won and friends so that she can tear this church apart and save her mother. Next, we have Han Sang-won, played by Ok Tae Kyun. He's the son of the governor, and his mom is in a vegetative state after an accident. And he witnessed Sang-mi's brother dying and hesitated to help him back then, while Sok Dong-chul went out and tried to help him. And that got Dong-chul sent to juvenile detention because he went against the kids of other influential people in Muji. Sang-won wanted to help Dong-chul. He asked for his father's help, but his father told him that they can't go against the other influential people in Muji because he's trying to get reelected as governor and, you know, this would be better for the whole family, this would be better for all of us, this would be better for your mother, this could help your mother wake up. Essentially, at that time when he was in high school, he was a coward who didn't do anything when it mattered and it led to Sang-jin's death, it led to Dong-chul getting sent to prison. So, years later, when he saw Sangmi asking for help again, he knew he had to do whatever he could to save her with the help of his friends. Similar to Sangmi, his debilitated mother is kind of being held hostage for him to stay complicit in whatever his father is doing. But he has to fight against that when he realizes that his father doesn't have their best interest at heart anymore. And lastly, we have Sok Dongchul, played by Woo Do-won. So Dongchul is Sangwon's best friend who grew up with a deadbeat dad and a grandmother who did everything to raise him and ended up dying while she was, you know, working to send him money when he was in juvie. So Dongchul has always been the headstrong type. He wanted to be a cop, but of course, when he was sent to juvie, those dreams died. And after getting out, he got into the host club business because that's the only place that would accept someone like him. But when Sangwon approached him asking for help to save Sangmi, he couldn't fight the urge to help again. Similar to Sangmi, he literally knows what it's like to be imprisoned because of people or powers above you that you have no control over. You know, he's the little guy fighting back against the people who have taken everything from him. So they also have two other friends. We have Jong-hoon, played by David Lee. He's the son of a local cop, and he finds out that his father doesn't believe in the cult but trusts them and kind of works with them. And Jong-hoon is a streamer who, you know, helps them expose the cult to the internet. And Man-hee, played by Han Hui-jong, is, you know, he's a nice guy. I mean, he's more sensitive than Jong-hoon. He's nicer than him. That's it. And, you know, why do these people help her? Well, they have nothing else to do. Like, that's literally in the synopsis that these are four unemployed guys who decide to help her. I have to admit, like, this part is shorter than I would like it to be because they're very one-note protagonists. I mean, two notes, if I'm being generous. It takes four episodes for them to get to the present day. It takes six episodes for you to hear the title. And then maybe 8 or 10 episodes for like a major shakeup to happen, right? And then after that, we go back to status quo, but slightly different. I kind of noticed that with Strangers from Hell as well, the other work of this writer, that there's this really creepy setting that we're exploring, and we're exploring the really creepy people that live in it or stay in it, but it doesn't really go far beyond that. It's just that setting exposing that setting for the creepiness of it all, and then, yeah, that's it. Darkhold, we don't talk about Darkhold. That was just bad. So honestly, given this writer's history, I would suggest they just work on movies. I think the way they write, the things that they write about, would be perfect for a 2-hour thriller. You don't need 16 hours for this. Not even 12 hours. Not even 10 hours. Okay? A 2-hour movie is perfect for the level of plotting that this person comes up with. So because the protagonists were very one-note to me and I wasn't really invested in them. Of course, I rooted for them, but to say that I was so invested in what they were going through, not so much. The villains, however, I was not invested in them. I thought they were more fascinating character studies. We have three main villains. So first you have, of course, the spiritual father, who is the leader of the cult, who, not so secretly, like by the end of episode 1, we know that he's a creep. We know that he wants to sexually assault Sangmi, and then eventually we find out that he is trying to make her into the spiritual mother, into his wife, who will save everyone's souls. So obviously that's just an excuse for him to be able to assault her. Then we have Apostle Kang Eun-sil. She leads the worship services, she lectures the new recruits, and she manages the nursing home. We find out, you know, many episodes later that she used to be a nurse. So she knows how to administer drugs to, you know, keep people hallucinating, to keep them incoherent. And obviously, that's what they're doing to Sangmi's mom. So she's the one who Sangmi interacts with the most, actually, because she's also training Sangmi to be the spiritual mother. And lastly, we have Apostle Jo Wante. He handles finances. He He takes donations from people, and he cleans up people's messes. You know, when they end up killing someone, or when the people that they're imprisoning in Gusan 1, you know, die. And he's also a creep himself. So, yeah, completely messed up. From the beginning, we know that these three are working together. They're a solid team. They're committed to sustaining this cult. But they have different perspectives or different levels of belief or delusion. The spiritual father is 100% a creep who has internalized this delusion so deeply that it doesn't crack. I don't even know if this guy knows that he's not the spiritual father anymore. He is constantly speaking in riddles, in prophecies, okay? There is no normal person behind this spiritual father mask. It's not a mask. He believes he is the spiritual father. He believes he is prophesizing, that he is hearing things from the mighty new sky. But of course, those revelations only serve his, you know, creepy desires. And he is entitled to people's love and to their worship and to the bodies of these young girls that he's waiting to assault. He's such a creep. Apostle Joe is definitely not a believer. He's obviously putting on a facade. When it's just the three of them, you can see that he's just indulging the spiritual father's, you know, talk about revelations and the mighty new sky. But deep inside, he's here for the money. He's here because he wants something. We find out that he actually knew who the spiritual father was before they started this whole cult. So he's not a believer. He does not believe in the mighty new sky or whatever. But he'll do what he has to do to keep this cult alive and to keep it profitable. Now, Apostle Kang is so interesting to me. So initially, before all of this started, she was just a believer. She was just a member of the cult. And then we find out that, similar to Sangmi, her daughter was supposed to be the spiritual mother, but her daughter couldn't stand the training and the disgusting intentions behind it. And she killed herself. And to make up for her failure with her own daughter, Apostle Kang is committed to making Sangmi the spiritual mother, even if she clearly hates it, and even if Sangmi reminds her of her own daughter. So the spiritual father is just pure evil. Okay, he completely believes in this. He just wants whatever he wants, and he will use the mighty new sky to justify everything. Apostle Joe is just greedy and ruthless, and Apostle Kang is a believer. She's a strong believer who still has some room for doubt. Eventually, these differences are what tears the perfect system of these three apart. And I was more interested in how they would implode and destroy each other more than seeing the protagonist succeeding. Like, I know them imploding is the goal of the protagonist's success, but I was more focused on their side of it rather than seeing the protagonist win. Do you get what I mean? Like, towards the last third of the drama, I was just less interested in the protagonist because I knew what they were trying to do. I knew that they couldn't get caught and they couldn't rely on the people that they wanted to trust. That's it. And there wasn't really much growth for them. Not that there was much growth for anyone, really. Not for these villains, definitely. But yeah, just the satisfaction of watching them fall apart. That was more interesting. Although now, as I am, thinking about it, I do see that this story was about the protagonists fighting against institutions or people that they were supposed to trust. Like, these are people who we first met in high school and then as unemployed, barely adults who don't know what to do with their lives. And the people that they used to trust as minors, as children, they can't count on them anymore. They have to make their own decisions and save themselves. They can't depend on their parents or the government or the police or religion to dictate how they live their lives anymore. Now, because this isn't really horror the way The Guest was, it's more of a psychological thriller. So instead, I'm gonna judge it not on the horror factor, but more on the creep factor. And this is very, very creepy. Like, one of my favorite directing moments was when they juxtaposed a ritual this shaman was doing so that they could speak to Sangjin's spirit, and then they would alternate that with shots from one of the worship services in Gusan 1 of people, you know, screaming, crying, wailing, believing that the spiritual father could cure someone by hitting their body. He could take the cancer literally out of someone's body. It's wild. for both of those. Because, of course, the shamanistic rituals, you know, the really loud gongs and then instruments, it's wild on both sides. And as outsiders to both of these, you can see that they're kind of the same, right? It's loud, people look like they're going out of their minds, but this is just how they express their beliefs. The directing is very, very good at evoking that feeling of being an outsider, looking at something that feels wrong, but everyone is so committed to and is believing. And the best thing about this cult, how they depicted the cult, is that there was no gimmick. I was afraid that, you know, the big reveal would be that, oh, they're actually putting drugs in the holy water that people are obsessed with. And, you know, people were hallucinating this whole time. That's how they're able to control the believers and how they make them more subservient to whatever the cult leaders say. They didn't do that, thankfully. Because in real life, you don't need to be drugged to believe in something crazy. They just believed. They just had faith in these teachings. And they believed that this was how they were going to be saved. That they must be obedient to secure their spot in the ship of salvation. To secure their happiness in the afterlife. And we also saw that many of the believers in this cult were struggling. You know, struggling with money, with abusive families. And they needed a way out of that situation. And the cult would also prey on those who are grieving. By worshiping the mighty new sky, in the afterlife, you can claim a spot for your dead loved one too. You can all come together on the ship of salvation and be saved. And these believers chose to give everything they had to Gusan One. Because, you know, if they weren't going to be happy in this life, they might as well secure their happiness in the afterlife. So funnily enough, the last week that I've been watching this drama was the same week that we were discussing terror management theory in class. So this is just what I picked up from my readings and my lectures. But the idea behind terror management theory is that there are only two truths in this life. You were born and you will die. Everything that happens in between, you have no idea if that will even happen. But there are only two things you're sure of. You were born, that's why you're here, and you will die. And that fear of death, that certainty of death, of non-existence, is the greatest fear at the core of everything that people do. And people live their lives trying to insulate themselves from that fear, protecting themselves from it, because succumbing to that fear would lead to despair, would lead to nothingness. It's the same as death. So they do things to protect themselves from that anxiety or to prevent it somehow. Whether that's by like health-promoting behaviors from eating healthy, exercising, or the opposite of that, which is never getting a checkup, never knowing about your health because you'd rather not know that there's something wrong with you. That's a way of avoiding the thought of death. Some people, to avoid non-existence, of no one ever knowing that you ever existed, they try to build a legacy so that they can be immortalized, quote-unquote, in people's memories. You know, why do people fund buildings so that they can name it after themselves? Like, how many buildings do you need named after you? It's because that immortalizes you somewhere in this world. That as long as you stand, as long as those buildings stand and your name is on it, you will continue to exist somewhere in people's minds. Or some people gain as much power or as much money as they can, which would lead to their safety, which would prevent their death. And of course, we have religion or any spirituality that promises immortality or promises an afterlife to avoid that non-existent, that you will not exist in this world, in this plane, but there is an afterlife for you. And people fall for these dangerous and these evil cults, not because they're simply gullible or, you know, they're actually sick and evil people and they want to support the disgusting things that these cult leaders do or the things that they're made to do. These cults are very, very good at exploiting people's fears and pain and giving them hope. They give you hope that there's a better life after death if you believe. And you will be rewarded if you follow all of our orders, if you follow all of our teachings. And you mustn't listen to any of the demons that are pretending to be humans outside of our walls. They are tempting you to break your faith. It was even stated explicitly in the show that, you know, it didn't matter if they had to lie to people to make them believe in the mighty new sky. They called it the salvation stratagem. Because if you lie to them and you make them believe, you're saving them. You are doing them a favor. So it's really sad that religion is something that's meant to give people hope and to give them community, and specifically for the characters. You know, it was to help them cope with their grief It was to help them settle and find a place to live. It was supposed to help them make meaning out of their lives. And it's unfortunate that all of that was twisted to fulfill the desires of these sick cult leaders. And it's so difficult to break the brainwashing that these cults have on their believers because they're told that doubting would lead to death and damnation. It's like an endless cycle. You understand why Sangmi feels so trapped, because these people are so deep in the teachings of this cult that they don't even see what they're doing anymore. I'd say the creepy factor is a 9 out of 10. It's so good at making you feel how wrong everything is and how no one is listening. But just like how this cult was selling hope to their believers, Sangmi also survived because she had hope that someone would listen to her someday. So that's it for me today. Overall, I see the themes of why people get into cults and how they become so deeply entrenched in its beliefs. And I saw at the end how the elements and the characters came together, because it's not just these guys. We have some police, we have some gangsters, we have reporters, we have politicians. There are so many elements and people and, you know, their own little agendas kind of getting intertwined in this cult. But the experience was so slow and drawn out, and, you know, characters disappeared and reappeared, and there were breadcrumbs to the terrible things that the cult was doing, but sometimes I felt like they were not consistent enough. I did not consistently see the hints to that until suddenly we find out they were keeping the homeless people in prisons as like sleeper agents that they would send forth to kill their enemies. Like, yes, that happened in episode, I don't know, 11 or something. It was so bizarre to me. I'd say worth it for Udoan alone and his just ability to elevate any scene that he's in. And if you want to watch something that's messed up, I mean, we all have those moods. And creepiness-wise, once again, 9 out of 10. But as a drama, I would rate it 6 out of 10. That's exactly the same rating that I gave Strangers from Hell. So, you know, says a lot. Consistently, I kept thinking while watching Save Me, this should have happened 2 episodes ago. Episode 1 actually should have been 30 minutes long, all of that. And then we would have combined parts from episode 2. Like, yes, consistently, if this were a 12-episode drama, this would be so much tighter. I think they could still accomplish the creepiness. And yeah, most of the plot lines and the characters and relationships that they put in here, I think they could have accomplished all of this in 12 hours. But you know, watching this in 1.5 times speed would have been a disservice to the creepy vibes it was supposed to give. So I don't regret watching it, you know, in normal speed, because I think that added to the experience. That's the best part of the experience. But yeah, looking at how things came together, it's a 6 out of 10. Now, Save Me 2 exists, but it's not a sequel to this. Like, of course, it's still about a cult, but it's not about the same characters. Yeah, nothing. A lot of people said it's not as good as the first season, but then when I was reading comments about it, I also saw people saying, yeah, Save Me 2 was slower, but it was more psychological. It focused more on why people in cults were so devoted. And because I was frustrated with the supposedly thrilling parts of Save Me 1 being too slow, the thrilling parts were too few and far in between for me to appreciate it as a psychological thriller, I'd rather a show commit to being slow rather than saying they're gonna make it thrilling, but yeah, not being fast enough, not being thrilling enough. So I'll get back to you if I ever, yeah, decide to watch season 2. But yeah, that's it for me today. That's it for my super spooky Halloween episodes. I'll see you next year, because I do not make a habit of watching shows that creep me out. That's it for me today. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you soon.